Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, well, Kroger's in the news again. We'll also talk about Big Lots opening their first store under their new store format, and we'll discuss IKEA potentially selling through third parties, as well as a couple of looking ahead stories, one in the grocery industry and one regarding Black Friday. Our interview guest today is Michael Reitblatt from Forder. He will join us to talk about the importance of security when it comes to e-commerce, but more importantly, the importance of not throwing certain e-commerce sales away because they look suspicious. He's got some shocking numbers that you'll want to hear later on in the show. But first, this, you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time. But maybe you're just not sure where to start. All this could potentially be yours, though, if you open a UPS store franchise.
The UPS store franchise does bring 35 years of franchising experience on board, and they were actually just ranked number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS store offers stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all of the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dreams come true. Stores are available in both small and large markets across the country, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right for you.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner is now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. Well, as mentioned prior to this, Kroger is in the news every week now, it seems, and this time it's for an executive relook at their long-term strategy, particularly as it pertains to their convenience store portfolio. And, you know, we talk about Kroger often on this show just because it seems like they've been in this news churn for a constant bit over the last 3 to 4 months, really ever since Amazon announced their sale of Whole Foods. This week, I saw some articles that said Kroger is struggling to survive. We wouldn't go that far, as they're still immensely profitable and immensely successful in what they do, and they still have positive same-store sales. A company like Sears Holdings is struggling to survive. Kroger's just struggling to maintain market share. Margin contraction and the termination of long-term guidance has made shareholders rather pessimistic as of late. But the company said Wednesday they'll be exploring strategic alternatives for their convenience stores. And this, of course, includes a possible sale. As we've talked about in the past on this show, anytime you hear the word strategic alternatives or the words strategic alternatives, that often means that the company is looking for a potential sale. And Goldman Sachs, no less, will be assisting in finding a potential suitor.
This really makes me think back to my managerial economics class, because really, if you're looking at the convenience store segment, one that we've talked about oftentimes because there's a lot of consolidation right now inside the United States, obviously 7-Eleven doing their thing, Quick Trip, among others, you're seeing that the margins there are very robust. Obviously, that's why there is a lot of contraction, a lot of people buying up convenience stores because they see a profitable future. So you have to wonder, looking at Kroger's store portfolio of over 780 convenience stores across 18 different states, looking at $4 billion in net sales. Obviously, that's not net income, but that is a very large part of Kroger's portfolio, and one that it really has been talked about as of late. We talked recently, Trent, about the Rite Aid Walgreens acquisition falling through, or at least iterations of it falling through. And you look there at the rumors of Kroger potentially buying some Walgreens or Rite Aid locations. And we were talking about how that would be a potentially great fit for Kroger because of their convenience store branch. And so you look at what they have in their portfolio now, and you look at where they want to be in terms of the supermarkets they have in their portfolio. Obviously, that is the majority of their revenue. That's where it comes from. But you look at these convenience stores and you're seeing a potential higher valuation. And honestly, that is something executives have pointed to here. And they're saying that because of that higher valuation, those multiples that others are paying for with these convenience store banners, potentially they could sell off, profit from that sale, and then reinvest back into their supermarkets. But they were not that specific, except to say things that we've heard in the past earnings calls. One thing is technology. They want more in-store technology. They've obviously been working with their other firms that they brought in-house for that. And you're seeing the other things too that they're going to be investing in as far as people, human capital. And I think this is a smart move, but again, this isn't something very specific. This is something they've been talking about over the last 2 years of earnings calls. We've been on the Retail Focus for almost 2 years now, and this is the same exact thing. So you really have to wonder, I mentioned managerial economics, is this capital going to be transferred into something that's as lucrative as those convenience stores? It's really just putting one asset and transferring that into another investment. And I think that could be questioned here. However, shareholders did like it. You mentioned the pessimism as of late. The shares were up around $2 after this announcement. They were trading around $19 to $20 a share. They popped to over $22 at one point this week. And you really have to wonder if shareholders are on board with that, or if they're just seeing that, oh, okay, yes, they are following through on that previous strategy that they outlined during the previous earnings calls. A lot of the fluctuation in share price oftentimes has to do with whether or not a company is following through on their larger managerial plans. And you can see here that through a lot of different rumors about other possible acquisitions, they are staying true to their overall core values.
You know, one thing you mentioned was the consolidation in the convenience store space, and that's not in this circumstance because companies are having a lack of success there. It's because these companies and these convenience stores do have those high margins that you discussed. And I went back and over the last couple of years, looked at some of the acquisitions in the convenience store sector. Alimentación Couche-Tard, of course, getting in on a lot of the acquisitions, especially with the Circle K banner acquiring different stores. You had the 7&I Company Holdings, which owns, of course, 7-Eleven. They're acquiring stores. Well, the average acquisition price on a store-by-store basis is about $3 million. And if you just do the back-of-the-napkin math here, $3 million per 780 convenience stores, that's well over $2 billion. That would be a nice capital influx, sure. But Leighton, you mentioned that these convenience stores had combined sales of $4 billion last year. That's because these convenience stores are larger format than the stores that have been purchased by Couche-Tard and by 7&I Holdings. And so you're going to see potentially higher multiples here and a higher cost per store, potentially even twice as much per store. But like you, I also question where exactly Kroger would be putting those billions of dollars to work. Would they just be boosting their bottom line one time, or would it be a capital reinvestment back into their business? And I think there is some question here as to whether or not this is a good long-term strategy for Kroger to divest their holdings in convenience stores. Anyone that's familiar with Kroger knows that they have very robust rewards programs, not only within their store, but tied into convenience stores where you get a certain amount of money off of gas. It's no different than a number of grocery store chains have throughout the country. But if you sell off those stores and you relinquish some control of those stores, including some of these C stores that are in your own parking lot, it's questionable as to whether or not these programs would continue on into the future. Now, Kroger has a lot of different brands of convenience stores, Loaf and Jug among them, Quick Shop as well in the Midwest. So they have a number of different brands to work with. If they wanted to sell off part or all of their portfolio, those are options that are on the table too. I think a lot of people are overreacting to the fact that it could be all 780 stores at once, when in reality, you're probably looking at a smaller portion of their store portfolio. And if they can sell off convenience stores in areas where maybe they're not doing quite as well, but they can still fetch a robust price for them, that's where you see the benefit for Kroger. But if they're selling off assets that are doing quite well in the short term, just to make shareholders happy in the short term, that's obviously going to hinder the company long term.
Well, I mentioned the stock price earlier and how it popped around $2 a share initially on all of this news and rumors. But overall, you see that the share price right now, as of recording this podcast, is around $21 a share, which is still fairly low because if you look at the year-to-date figures, You're seeing back in January, it was around $34 a share. So really, the share price has been cut over 40%, and you've seen precipitous drops. And you really have to wonder if they are going to be bringing shareholders all of that continued value that they have promised. But again, Kroger is a company that has a robust dividend, and they keep increasing the dividend sequentially. This is something that the company is known for. This is something that institutional investors love. And if you look at that price to earnings ratio, that may be something that value investors love. Currently, 12.7 is that price to earnings multiple. And you see that brings a current market cap of around $17.8 billion. So to be honest, Trent, this is a company I had invested in previously, and I had got out on a brief swing trade, but this is a company that I am officially looking forward to now as a potential long-term hold because of that value proposition. I think this company, again, I'm not an analyst, full disclosure there. I think this company could easily get around mid-30s by this time next year if all goes well. And there are a lot of other rumors surrounding the idea that they could be buying up other chains. Obviously, Sprouts has been in the news, and a whole delays as well. So a lot in store for Kroger, and we are curious to see what happens in the upcoming year. Well, Big Lots is looking to make shopping more fun and engaging, and that is in quotations, fun and engaging there, with its new store format in a grand opening in its Mesa location, Mesa, Arizona. Last week, in a formal press release, Big Lots discussed their new format and celebrated in what they saw as a milestone for the company. This is something that the company relayed to investors as recently as September. They were saying that this is going to be a new format store, and they had mentioned this in their annual investor presentation on September 18th, logically titled "The Store of the Future." The location pays greater attention to the placement of functional categories. It looks like they want areas to be more easily accessible, which is logical, to their customers, and they are using the Big Lots locations as a one-stop shop for quick household necessities. They say they want these locations to be sort of like a neighborhood center, so you have a little bit of everything in these Big Lots. And Trent, this is something that we've been talking about a lot, especially in the earnings reports, where you see the rollout of the freezers and coolers in different locations throughout the country. And I think that's extremely important, because if you think of Big Lots, you don't just think of household goods anymore. You don't just think of furniture. You think of the whole package. And while their product mix is not that accomplished, I think Big Lots has done a lot in the recent past to really promote their differentiated items. And you look at the ceremony for the grand opening. It was held on Friday, October 6th. They actually did a lot for this. The executives went all out. They're giving away gift cards. They're giving money to charity, matching donations, things of that nature. And as part of this formal announcement, the retailer tried to acquire positive PR by doing such things. The hospital partnership that they've announced with Nationwide Children's Hospital, that actually dates back to around 2016, according to the company website. So a lot of things surrounding this just one store. But Trent, this is a company that has been struggling as of late. You see their stock price fairly stagnant year to date. But I think this is, again, a positive PR move and a positive direction for the company. If you look at the pictures from within, the media outlets were covering this over a month ago as people were setting up the merchandise. I think this is a positive direction overall.
And you mentioned all of these things that they're doing for the grand opening, and you might ask, well, is this something that they do typically for a grand opening to try and generate positive PR? But they really don't. This is one of the few grand openings where it seems like Big Lots has put a lot of their eggs into this basket. They want people to check out and preview the new store space. And again, Big Lots wants to make that transition from a business closer to an Ollie's Bargain outlet where you're not sure what you're going to get every day. It's transferring away from the Big Lots, Odd Lots campaign of the 90s and early 2000s. And they want to become more of a center of everyday value for the customer. And I think that's why it's noteworthy. And obviously, that's why we're talking about it here, is this larger organizational switch where Big Lots wants to become less of a bargain hunt for the customer. They still want that bargain hunt aspect in there, especially with their larger margin categories like furniture that have been more successful. But for things like HBA items and food items, they want to become an everyday value for the consumer, not unlike how Dollar General has positioned themselves in the marketplace, regardless of whether or not they actually are an everyday value for the consumer. Now, on September 18th, Big Lots affirmed guidance for their full year fiscal 2017 financials. This was surrounding, again, their Investor Day, and their presentation for Investor Day has been taken down off their website. But Leighton and I got a chance to look in on that during September when they previewed this new store format. And honestly, the company was reasonably bullish on some of their initiatives. They didn't sound as despondent as honestly Big Lots sounded like back in 2016 during the same event. Now, this guidance includes a modest earnings per share range and same-store sales improvements of low single digits, which again is better than some of the same-store sales shrinkage we had seen over the last several quarters. This store of the future that they outlined during this Investor Day, they have new positive messaging. What they see is positive messaging through strategically placed signage. So they're getting more and more into merchandising. They're getting more and more into in-store signage. It's no longer just like a bargain hunt or a garbage dump there of repurchased merchandise on the shelves. They're trying to get better at the merchandising. They're trying to get better at consistency. And it starts with a new store model and a new store format. They mentioned a hello sign at front and a thank you one upon exiting, much as what you would see with many retailers. Walmart, of course, one of the first retailers to kind of make those signs standard throughout the country about a half century ago. As far as product mix is concerned, these new stores will have more apparel, which we found interesting considering apparel is a category that many general merchandise retailers have been struggling with, but they also want the store to be more streamlined so that people know what to expect. You walk in and you know exactly which section is where. The Big Lots I live closest to, they've done floor plan redesigns on such a regular basis over the last few years that it seems like there are certain categories that are constantly in flux. HBA is one of those categories. And if you're going in, you're a habitual consumer of an item that they carry in that segment, in the health and beauty aid segment, it's annoying to have to go and try to find it time after time. It's a similar criticism that's been lobbed at Walmart over the last few years. As they were preparing to develop this store, Big Lots did seem to look extensively at what they've been selling more of, highlighting those categories. We talked about furniture earlier. That's a big one, as well as seasonal. So they're trying to highlight furniture and seasonal, bringing those closer to the front of the store in some Big Lots locations, especially Big Lots locations that were built prior to when furniture was a big category for them. They've got furniture sometimes shoehorned in the back of the store. That's not the case here with this store of the future, as it's featured a little bit more prominently. Sure, it's not in the front of the store, but at least it's not in some back corner where they had to blow out part of their warehouse to try and accommodate the new furniture settings that they had in the late 90s and early 2000s. And their renewed focus on convenience does have to do with the consumables category, which has been a growing area for Big Lots in the recent past. Leighton already discussed freezers and coolers being installed in many, if not all, of their 1,428 locations. And this was highlighted in some of the pictures of this new Mesa, Arizona location that were circulating before the ceremonial opening. Also from these pictures, there's a greater reliance on pods, which makes sense if they're going to be focusing more on seasonal transitions going forward. Pods traditionally, in terms of merchandising, are areas that are more flexible rather than just having to blow out a certain section of your store where you're constantly going over refreshes. Pods make it easier to go through refreshes at a bit of a slower rate, so you can have kind of 1 foot in one season and 1 foot in another season. We mentioned signage, but also pricing indicators are going to be included down aisles. For example, subcategories of items under or above a certain dollar amount or in a given range will be targeted with signage. Leighton, one thing I think people should take away from this is that not all Big Lots throughout the country are going to be renovated immediately. This isn't a massive capital expenditures path for Big Lots. They're going to be doing this slowly. They're going to be assessing whether or not it works. And I view the Mesa, Arizona location more as a test market.
Yeah, so it looks to be more of a slower rollout overall, to your point. And I think that's a fairly positive thing for the company, because Big Lots isn't some massive company. Yes, they have over 1,400 locations, as you mentioned, but this is going to be good for the company because In terms of planning, this is something they want to be trying out in a slow manner. See what works, see what best practices they can roll out to more of their locations. And I think the company is planning to convert their existing store base, the entirety of it, in time, but have not provided a strict schedule to adhere to. And again, not only does that really help in terms of identifying best practices, but in terms of the remodels, or what Wendy's calls re-imaging all of the stores at once, is certainly not feasible and would certainly eat into their bottom line. And they had actually just announced a dividend, and that would probably not exist if they did all of their stores at once. Not only that, there still may be a few stores that will close in the short to midterm, as the company has looked to close underperforming locations in the recent past. This is something we've talked about, especially markets in the Midwest, Trent. We see a lot of concentration, a lot of Big Lots that have actually underperformed in the recent past, and the company executives from earnings calls have said they're not at all afraid to close underperforming locations. However, it appears from the most recent statements made by CFO Tim Johnson that management is ready for change overall, and they will be steadfast in reinvestment in the coming years. But again, no long-term time frame for all of these locations. It is good to see, though, that they are reinvesting in their store footprint. And to be honest with you, Trent, this is something they do need to do. We were obviously traveling to Los Angeles for shop.org, but I also made it to Colorado. I had spoke about that very briefly on our last podcast, and I went to 3 Big Lots in the Colorado area, and the product selection in most of those Big Lots is, in fact, inconsistent. And this is something that you had talked about in terms of streamlining the products. They want their core customer to know what to expect when they go into a Big Lots. And I was a little disappointed because I wanted some snack items. I wanted some food items. They carry a lot of organic selection where I live. And this is something they actually didn't have in some of the Colorado stores. So that was one thing. And another thing was signage. It wasn't always clear. It was inconsistent. And that related to seasonal, and that was laid out poorly. And we talked about pods. They had pods. One pod was seasonal. The next pod was maybe stationary, then seasonal. So it was very disorganized in that way. Additionally, there were initial features of snacks and other food items that I actually liked. I like being able to come into the store, and the first thing you see is those cheaper snacks. Stores, however, were dirty overall, in my opinion. And this is something that I think management has been addressing. A lot of people compare some older Big Lots locations to Aldi's Bargain Outlet. And if you look at the in-store concept, Aldi's Bargain Outlet is a little bit dirtier. They care a little bit less about merchandising. That is, to your point, Trent, something management is trying to shy away from. Locations are prime. This was the one key that I wanted to point out here, and that all of these locations, both in LA and in those Colorado areas that I traveled to, high retail traffic areas. And so I think not only is it prime real estate, but it's prime traffic. I think there's going to be a lot of traffic that are coming through. And yes, maybe Big Lots is not going to be their primary destination, but why not go in and try to see if you can't find something you may want? And I think that plays into how they're trying to expand their apparel selection. And if we look at the share price, like I said, stagnant as a company, from $49 a share at the beginning of the year to right around $52 a share as of recording this podcast. Relatively stable, yes, but a price to earnings ratio that's not indicative of massive growth at 13.5, a market cap of just $2.21 billion. I think this is why the company is going into a different direction. They really want to create that value for shareholders, sustainable value. And with that, they want to create a perception of cleanliness and a new store format for their customers.
To put a bow on a couple of things you said, one, regarding shelf tags and that signage, keep in mind for those unfamiliar with the Big Lots format, they place stickers on a lot of their merchandise, which of course requires man hours and time. Oftentimes their UPC or barcode scanning system tied in with the stickers they're placing on merchandise. But some of their merchandise, their stable merchandise that they rotate in and out on a regular basis, those don't receive stickers. So there is, in the past, less of an emphasis on shelf tags because all of their products were stickered. And now, as you're seeing Big Lots become a retailer, retailer that wants to be more of that one-stop shop, you're seeing that re-emphasis on shelf tags and signage. The other aspect of it, you mentioned the high traffic locations, and I'm glad you did, because I look at Big Lots as a company that if they choose to continue to expand in the future, they're going to have their selection of a number of different larger retail locations that have closed. We look at Sports Authority being one of those locations, but even going back to the 90s, we talk about all these bargain outlets snapping up these old Kmart stores. Going back to the 1990s, Big Lots was one of the first to do this. They took over a number of old Children's Palace and Child World locations after they went bankrupt. They took over a few bankrupted Alco stores from their first bankruptcy in the 90s. So they're no stranger to this concept, and I think it will save them money on real estate over the next few years were they to open more of this new and larger store concept. Well, we talked about it at the top of the show, but there are a lot of perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, the ability to be your own boss, and having more control of your time, so much so that you might start a retail podcast. Maybe not one that competes directly with us, but maybe a different retail podcast, right? But maybe you're just not sure where to start. All of this, though, could be yours if you choose to open a UPS store franchise.
One of the things about being a business owner, or at least being a new business owner, is you are going to be a little bit risk averse. Well, with the UPS store, they bring in decades of franchising experience, and they were just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS store brings that stability I talked about, but also the support and reputation of the world-renowned brand and a proven business model. Through that experience, with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dreams come true. I mentioned the large and small formats. Again, they're available across the country, so get with their franchising experts now and figure out what location is just right for you.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner could be now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. Well, our shop.org interview series continues, again brought to you by gainloans.com here at shop.org. We're joined now by the CEO of Forter, Michael Reitblatt. And before we get into specifically what Forter does and how Forter helps companies and that type of thing, largely you guys are focused on e-commerce fraud prevention, correct? So just how important is it for an e-commerce retailer, anyone basically with a digital e-commerce presence, to focus on fraud prevention? How many problems might you have if you don't focus on it?
So first, allow me to thank you for having me here. Good morning in LA, and good third day of the conference. When we talk about fraud prevention, a lot of people, a lot of retailers, don't really understand where it hurts them, and they have different perspectives. Just to clarify, because some people may not know that, every time an online transaction happens, transaction that's called card not present, where the physical card was not actually swiped or inserted, the liability is on the retailer. If anything bad happens, if someone uses a stolen card, that's the retailer's problem, not the banks or the networks, in almost all the cases. And that causes kind of the first problem people think about is, how much money am I losing? How much money are fraudsters stealing away from me by buying product with stolen cards? And I think the average numbers across the US industry is about slightly below $4 billion are stolen every year from merchants because people buy with stolen credit cards. I'm talking e-commerce only, so e-commerce is kind of any type of retail definition. If we start adding more verticals to the mix of online travel and any other types of online businesses, that number more than doubles itself. Naturally, that's US only. If you start expanding internationally, triple that again. We're getting into big billion numbers. But that's actually maybe the least interesting number in the whole story. What almost all the retailers and all the online companies do is they become way more defensive and conservative than they should be. So they start building an internal operation, leveraging tools and different data providers and internal modeling, just rule setting to make sure they review the transactions and don't lose the money that we just talked about. But what it creates is they turn away a lot of good business. There are different ways to estimate how much money is being lost there, but even the most conservative assumption is that more than $20 billion of good orders are lost every year by U.S. retailers because something looks suspicious. And suspicious may be, oh, the IP is from China, but you're shipping to a hotel in New York, something doesn't add up. Oftentimes, those transactions are actually being declined by the payment processors. Just an example from last week, we met a customer that uses one of the top three payment processors. They said, oh, we actually don't have a fraud problem. We barely have any chargebacks and we don't decline anything, which from our experience is not possible. So I asked to see their processing statement, like show me the data. And I look at this and like, well, your processor is actually declining 22% of your business and you're not aware of it. I'm like, no, it's not actually a problem because that's only when AVS, which is an address verification system, says negative, or when the shipping address is different from the billing address. So from their perspective, oh, that's not, of course it's fraud. And no, in 95% of those cases, it's a legitimate order. So they just lost almost a quarter of their business, which is insane in my view.
Basically, what I've gotten from this early part of the conversation is it's almost as important for retailers to figure out what's not fraud as it is for them to figure out what it is, because right now they're eliminating just a large swath of possible transactions based on assumptions or guesses, more or less.
It's even more important, right? And I'll add another layer on top of that. All the protection mechanism the retailers are putting in place, all the address checks, or the limitation of where you can ship things, how many orders can you buy when you're a first-time buyer, can you use a freight forwarder, for instance, right? We know that a lot of international buyers don't want to pay the international shipping, or the retailer may not ship there, so they'll use an official freight forwarder, or sometimes it's an unofficial one. It's their friend from Malaysia that just lives in Pittsburgh, and all the city sends all the packages there, right? I used to do that. I live in New York. I send a lot of stuff to my house, and then when I go back to Israel, I take them with me. So a retailer can consider me very suspicious because a lot of cars are buying and shipping stuff to my address. But all of those limitations actually create a substantially worse user experience. It makes a longer checkout process because you're asking for way more details than you should. You put a lot of hurdles in. I think the latest number is almost in 10% of the cases, 10% of transactions are being manually reviewed by the retailer. So there's a person, forget the cost of that associated to it, but there's a person looking at a transaction. It means you can't ship it immediately. If it's a digital product, it gets stuck. If you want to offer next day air shipment, you can't because a person needs to review it. Or you will say everything's fine and the buyer will anticipate to receive it, but then he gets an email early morning saying, oh, well, something was wrong with your transaction. You're not getting the product you thought. Consider the impact and the negative emotions in this, especially at peak times when there's holidays and you want everything as fast as possible, but you can't. Creates a lot of negative emotions and thus kind of repeatable loss of business.
The Forder platform to me seems to be predicated upon accuracy. And so you're trying to tell retailers, merchants online, not be risk averse. They don't want to lose that business. So how are some of the things that the company has been doing to be more proactive, to be able to adapt more quickly to fraudulent threats? I mean, because we all know as time goes on, not only is the technology behind preventing fraudulent transactions getting better, but obviously the AI behind those type of fraudulent transactions, that's also increasing also.
Yes. So I'll start by saying our mission, right? We've been in the fraud prevention world for over 15 years or detecting different types of malicious activities online. And I think it's kind of for historical reasons that the retailers are left alone to fight fraudsters in this, and it's not their job. They shouldn't be left with that problem. They are not really equipped to deal, and it's not their focus. And so what we wanted to do, and we've created that, is kind of restoring back the balance. People who are not familiar with Forder, what we are doing is we're shifting the burden of dealing with fraud away from the retailers to us. We will review all the online orders. We'll make a real-time, 100% real-time decision that says approve or decline. That's a yes or a no. There's no maybe, there's no score, there's no we think this looks suspicious. It's a definitive decision, and it's a definitive action where if we approved something and it's fraud, that's on us. So from that moment, merchants starting working with us, they know they're safe. They don't have to do anything. They can focus all of their efforts and all of their engineering and the smart people that they hire on more important things, getting more customers, serving them properly and so on. And all the fraud is being taken care of. Now, the moment we're in a centralized position, so we work with a variety of merchants from different verticals, we process over $20 billion worth of online transactions now. We can centralize the resources, right? So we have a engineering team of over 70 people in Israel, so we can get the best and brightest. Like we hire out of PayPal and Google, not the other way around. and we can make the investment to build a product that no retailer can in any way build on their own, and leverage all the data that we're seeing, which is what creates the superior accuracy.
Can you speak to the streamlining of forecasting? Looking through your platform, that's one of the advantages in that the CFO can better predict their sales, because with declining transactions that could be legitimate, that's obviously a loss of revenue, a loss of profit long term. Have you seen through the data and relationships you've built up to this point a true legitimate advantage from the CFO or the accounting perspective that you're able to offer new companies, new potential partnerships, and really saying, listen, we can actually boost your top line revenue while lowering your risk portfolio?
So CFOs love us, right? CFOs get three important benefits in a financial. The first thing, we hedge their losses, right? So they no longer have to explain, we've lost more money this quarter because of an unexpected fraudulent attack. Equifax was a big boom, so everyone heard about it, but there are breaches happening all the time. So you know, once this happens, you should expect your fraud losses going up, but you don't know whether you'll be attacked or not. So it's all very unpredictable. And once you work with us, it's hedged, right? Because it's a fixed price, everything you're paying for, and we're taking care of the rest. That's the first benefit. The second benefit is all the cost savings, right? You don't need the tools and the data and the people that I've mentioned. You can leverage those resources for something else. And the third, which is the most important one, is your top line goes up. Consider of the business is getting bigger, more happier customers, but also top line revenue. This is where all the financials start. And I think in all the cases, with all the customers we've worked with, we've seen a substantial lift top line revenue from maybe 5 to 30% in some cases.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about the world of fraud prevention is that really there's another hidden aspect to it, and it's brand recognition and the marketing aspect of it. We've seen so many times, whether it's Wendy's or Target or someone else, when there's a huge data breach, suddenly people are more hesitant about shopping and people don't feel as secure shopping at that retailer. So what are some of the ways in which you've seen the retailers that you work with seem to drive security of the customer so you ultimately get a more positive experience, but also the brand is thought of in a more positive way?
I think when the Target breach happened, right, oftentimes that's a cybersecurity issue, right? But consumers associated with, oh, can I trust any merchant online? Not even thinking of that, the big brand. Think of what the small brands that are unrecognized by the consumers. Can I trust them by giving them our card? And what I think the banks did pretty well is saying, no matter what happens to you, consumer, you're protected. If someone steals your card or uses it in a wrong way, it's annoying, right? You have to call the bank, you have to explain what happened, you have to get a new card. But it's financially you're protected. As long as you're mindful, right, you're checking your balance sheet, you know what's happening, I don't think consumers should ever be afraid of leaving their credit cards online because of how the system works. But the system is unfair in the sense that they all just shifted all the liability over to the retailers, go deal with it. More so, and the retailer's not as effective in preventing fraud, and then different networks have different thresholds, they can lose their whole ability of processing money, because their merchant account is getting taken away from them. Basically, the bank's saying, well, too many of your Visa transactions have been fraudulent. We don't want you to spoil the Visa brand, because now consumers don't trust Visa. There's a whole chain effect here. And once again, the merchants are left dealing with it on their own.
All right. So as we wrap it up here, Michael, is, you know, obviously a lot of people come to shop.org. They've got large announcements, you know, surrounding their appearance at shop.org. What can we expect from Porter as a company going forward? Is there anything new that you're rolling out here? Anything that you're working on? Obviously, without, you know, giving away too many company secrets and that type of thing.
Sure. So we're always working. I mean, fraud prevention is a continuous problem, right? Every day, fraudsters are getting smarter and they're getting more data to use. And kind of worse than that, they're actually learning to leverage technology faster than everyone else. And they automate and they use different types of AI technologies to attack retailers. And we need to make sure that the first core business of Porter is making sure that our system is a step ahead of the fraudsters and not just responding to what they're doing, because that way you'll always be losing a lot of money. So we invest a lot in proactive research. I mean, we knew something happened before the Equifax announced it. We just saw a spike in account takeover activity. We saw a spike of data that looks really well organized and shouldn't be out there. And we saw a lot of communication between fraudsters trying to get something. We didn't know it was Equifax, but it was clear there was something out there, and it's a very important tool for us. Additionally, we're expanding our protection, not just for credit card transactions, right? We cover all type of online payments, because we want the consumers to have the same, let's call it, Amazon experience, right? You can pay whatever you want, you can ship wherever you want, and everything is instant. And we want every merchant to be able to offer that if it fits their business without thinking, what does it do to my risk prevention? I remember from the times when we worked at PayPal, we wanted to roll a new initiative. It was, this will be great for consumers, but that will be too risky. We won't do that. That's no longer a conversation a merchant has. Whatever's good for the business, you go do it, because we got you covered on whatever the fraud prevention implications of it. And we will always choose to err at the side of approving someone, because you can kind of think of it as every person we approved and turned out to be a fraudster, because our technology is so accurately identifying the people, we know that's another person we won't trust in the future. So it's almost a research and development expense for us, when for a merchant, it's just a loss from their bottom line. So we're rolling out and expanding our protection to, right, account takeover, to any type of interaction that consumers may have with merchants, to make sure the merchants are protected and everything's optimized for user experience, making sure it's easier for the buyers to buy what they want and get it when they want and pay however they want. It doesn't have to be a credit card. It doesn't have to be in the specific flow the payment processor shows them.
Obviously, a vastly growing industry, a growing company there at Forter, a company that's international, over 130 countries you have a presence in. Is that correct?
So we have customers all over the place, right? We have customers in Asia. We have customers in the majority of our focus is still in the U.S. We have a big office in New York. All of our engineering is actually in Israel. We're rolling now our international presence to several other countries. But we process, we already approved transactions from almost, so from 188 countries. So we're really agnostic of where the buyers are coming from. Everyone's welcomed, because e-commerce, that's what it opens up the world, right? If you have people that don't have a Walmart next to them, they go online and they buy stuff. They're potentially your best audience, but oftentimes we see people in the U.S. saying, oh, IP from Indonesia, all the Indonesians are fraudsters, which is completely incorrect. But some of them are very active fraudsters, so they create a lot of noise.
So for those online merchants that are interested in something like this, would like to add that into their business model, how would they be able to get a hold of Forter and the services you provide?
So first, you can always email me directly. It's michael@forter.com. But we also have, it's easy to find information about us on our site, which is www.forter.com. There's a lot of case studies and useful white papers and information we have on the website people can read and judge for themselves, right? We have actually had Forrester talk to our customers without us in the room and just figuring out what the value that they see in our service. It's amazing how different customers see different value, but when you stack it up, the ROI is just amazing. It's really, you sign here and you make more money.
That's good stuff, and it's moreover an enlightening conversation about something that we don't often have the chance to talk about here in e-commerce fraud prevention. Again, Michael Reitblatt with Forter, CEO, and I hear you're traveling overseas tomorrow, so safe travels and enjoy the rest of shop.org.
Thank you. It was great talking to both of you. Good luck. Hope to talk to you more in the future.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we once again want to thank Michael Reitblatt from Forter for joining us again at the shop.org conference, an enlightening conversation about e-commerce security and really some astounding numbers there. You think about how many transactions some of these companies are throwing away simply because they appear suspicious when they're really not all that suspicious. It seems like a service akin to what Forter has could be the next frontier of e-commerce security, where you divest the risk, if you will, as the retailer. Well, we pick up the second half of our news portion of our show with IKEA, a company that we don't talk about a ton here on The Retail Focus. They're following in the footsteps of other traditionally brick-and-mortar retailers with a 2018 plan to sell through third-party websites. Sears has done this recently via Amazon, and apparel companies are also always looking for ways to reach a broader consumer base. So we've seen a variety of apparel retailers do this over the last few years. But despite the rumors and the clickbait headlines you might have seen, IKEA has not formally announced any partnerships, and a spokeswoman said that there have been no final decisions regarding the matter. The company's strategic direction is said to be evolving over the next few years, most likely to compete with the ever-growing Wayfair.com, who we talked about on their last earnings call. As for a typical cookie-cutter response to further questioning, IKEA representatives said that they will, in the shorter term, look to execute in their current channels. That's something we hear a lot from just about every retailer, so nothing new there.
Absolutely, and they have around 20 locations in North America, and that is something they still have to focus on. Obviously, branching out to third-party websites is going to be a smaller part of their business in terms of revenue. IKEA is known for their massive stores, their massive amount of inventory, and that customer service, but that is going to be a little bit differentiated in 2018, it looks like. And what is noteworthy is the fact that IKEA operates their own e-commerce sites already. So one may ask, are they going to be shutting those down? Are they going to be putting more resources into these third-party relationships in time? I would say the answer is no. But as you had alluded to, Trent, we have no clear answers with these media headlines, with these stories that came out earlier this week. This tells us either that they aren't seeing sufficient traffic in their locations or their e-commerce website, or it may be cheaper to acquire customers on a more established platform that offers those built-in mechanics that we always talk about. We talk about during this episode's interview, in fact, those safety features, those security features as far as data is concerned that Amazon has in-house, that eBay has in-house. And so currently, IKEA does a great job of promoting certain events for their home improvement areas inside of their website, but perhaps they might find it a little bit easier to sell directly to their consumers through these other partnerships. These partnerships that, again, have been going on for quite some time now, and you're seeing different iterations of them as well. We're talking about these rumors of Kohl's expanding their partnerships with Amazon in 2018, and IKEA may be looking to do the same thing. Obviously, we don't have any names or any finalized deals with any third-party vendors. However, you do see some areas of opportunity when you're looking at the US IKEA site. I was on there recently, and you're looking at areas, particularly in their categories on their website, that could be improved as they showcase more vague categories like textiles, living room, business. What are those categories? You have to kind of click through several times to really understand their product mix. And that's a little different because if you go to their stores, you understand that, yeah, they do segment a lot of their product mix in those stores. But on the website, they're trying to do similar actions. But e-commerce is not the same thing as brick and mortar. And I think IKEA has a little bit of a difficult time trying to execute in that way. Their US website to us seems a little scattered, a little bit more focused on the themes over products, which again is something they do with their in-store merchandising traits. This might not translate over time with e-commerce. I would actually personally like to see more how-to videos on their website because obviously if you buy some furniture, anybody who's bought furniture at IKEA knows that you have to put it together. Sometimes that can be a pain, but they don't have a lot of tutorials, and they did have one link halfway down their homepage, their home tour link. However, it was broken. And so I think there's a lot of money that could be spent on their website, but it really makes you wonder, really makes you understand why they may be investing in 2018 into these third-party relationships. This is something that a lot of companies have been looking towards because these established platforms not only bring those mechanics that I talked about, that safety and security, they're already bringing in a vast network of users. Obviously, that is what Amazon wants. They have an ecosystem of users that have Amazon credit cards, they have Amazon Prime, and so perhaps IKEA would be better off leveraging that user base and bringing in more customers overall, and maybe that's what they want. Get more people familiarized with the brand because we all know IKEA is in those larger metropolitan areas inside the United States. A lot of people who live in cities with 500,000 people or less are completely unaware of IKEA and their overall business model. So I think there's a lot of things they could do here. Not only that, perhaps they're looking to just invest in digital overall.
You know, it's interesting because when we go to shop.org or any other conference regarding retail, we hear a lot about now meeting the customer where they're at, making things more convenient to the customer, taking out those points of friction, whether in brick and mortar or e-commerce. And that's something that IKEA hasn't focused on as yet. And part of the reason is because they're beating their own same-store sales goals almost universally across the board. If you go into an IKEA, they actually have sales goals listed towards the front in the pickup area of the store, not where you first enter in, but down near the checkouts. And in every IKEA I've ever been in, they're beating their own in-store goals and they're beating their same-store sales from the prior year by a significant margin. We're talking, in some cases, double-digit same-store sales increases. So they haven't really been in the position to have to meet the customer where they're at. And I think right now they kind of realize that they have to do something to streamline their approach, because their in-store approach, if we talk about removing these friction points, well, there are a lot of friction points if you go into an IKEA. If it's your first time in there, if you're a first-time consumer, it can be confusing. If you're using buy online, pickup in store options, those are equally confusing. It takes a while to get to the buy online, pickup in store area. So there are a lot of things that they could do. And by partnering with other e-commerce sites, you can remove those friction areas a little bit more seamlessly because, as Leighton mentioned, you're using the infrastructure that that company has already developed. And they've begun to use other digital partnerships of late. And one of the challenges that companies online as a whole have been trying to address is realistic modeling of their products. Furniture in particular is one area that customers, of course, want to feel confident in before they click to buy, which is why Wayfair executives have talked extensively about their photo presentation and 3D modeling. And Leighton mentioned that's really just not there on the IKEA website. Even tutorials that would be really quick to shoot and edit from a video standpoint and put online, a number of other e-commerce furniture retailers have those type of tutorials. Those are missing on IKEA's website. And Apple has been investing even more into augmented reality to give potential customers of theirs a more realistic perspective of how something may look in their home. IKEA has created an app that will work with some of Apple's current capabilities in this augmented reality space, where you can take some items from their virtual showroom and drop them in the floor space in front of your phone's camera. From there, you can maneuver the items by a somewhat simple drag and drop tool. So this is an example of IKEA partnering with the company in Apple to create a digital format, an augmented reality format that might be able to assist their customers in their needs or their goals. And we'll talk to a company next week that's actually developing holograms and that type of thing for retail stores. Maybe that's something that IKEA can take advantage of in the future and utilize those in their brick and mortar space to try and make that a little bit more seamless for the customer as well. There are, of course, limitations. These include an inability to adjust precisely in certain room corners. Of course, you're not going to be able to get quite an exact fit around furniture that you already have. But still, I think it's a positive sign for IKEA that they are attempting to at least streamline this for the consumer. But at the same time, you kind of wonder why now and why not 5 years ago. I tend to believe it's because they are seeing pressure on their top line from other retailers who are doing a better job in the e-commerce space and who are removing those points of tension or those high traffic points within their stores. IKEA, again, it's going to be an experience. It's going to be a trip that's going to take all day. But for your generalized consumer that just wants a few home improvement products or just a few shelves or something like that, they're probably going to go to other retailers in the future. One such retailer being At Home, for example. They've had a massive amount of success over the past few years, despite their e-commerce platform really not being robust, but it's because they've worked so much on developing that in-store model that works seamlessly for the customer. They can go and find directly exactly what they want, and that's something that IKEA just has not developed. Well, it's time for the final segment on the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I tell you about a story we're keeping our eye on over the next week or the next month or perhaps the next year. And we begin with Leighton.
Well, we occasionally cover holiday sales or sales around big events. And retail sales are expected to be slightly up this year around the typical Black Friday season. However, a recent study by MarketTrack LLC said, based on 1,000 U.S. customer surveys, that only 30% of respondents said they would actually shop in brick and mortar stores, brick and mortar formats. That's actually lower than the 50% that they had coming in last year. So that's a little bit different. And then for Black Friday itself, the day after Thanksgiving, the typical Black Friday sales are around 50% or more brick and mortar. This year, respondents said only 40% of them would come in during those shopping hours. And I think this is going to be interesting because you see this dynamic playing out over the last 2 years, where obviously customers are shopping more on that Monday following Black Friday on their websites, their favorite websites, Amazon, Best Buy, all of those websites having all of those great deals that are comparable, if not better, than what you would find in store. And one last statistic that really didn't surprise me was actually talking about the fact that most of these items that are going to be shopped online are going to be electronics, TVs, and a lot of sporting good items among apparel items as well. So again, this really isn't differentiated from last year, and this is just a trend to the e-commerce space that we've been seeing over the recent years, and this is something that will continue to happen. However, a lot of people, Trent, call us permabulls in terms of brick and mortar and the retail industry. That we are. Brick and mortar is here to stay. And to be honest with you, this really doesn't change my perception of how brick and mortar is going to be changing in the next couple of years. It's still going to be necessitated by omnichannel platforms and the like, especially by those larger retailers that I mentioned. And in addition, Target, Walmart, those kind of companies that recognize the value of having those physical stores in place.
In the grocery industry that's been in flux, it seems like, over the past 3 months, everyone has talked about the draining effect on traffic that Whole Foods and Amazon has had and that Lidl has had on the East Coast. But lost in all this are the continued expansion efforts of one very notable grocer that doesn't get talked about a whole lot because they are a private company, and that's Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's, if you watch them closely, they've opened 6 locations so far in October of 2017. This brings the total locations they've opened up in the third quarter of 2017 up to 10. So while everyone is talking about traffic flooding away from the grocers that have been out there for a long period of time, and they've talked about pressures that might be put on Trader Joe's by Whole Foods, reduced prices in only certain areas, Trader Joe's is still plugging away, and they're still opening locations throughout the country. And the more important part is they're expanding their market presence in certain areas. Much like what Layton talked about with IKEA earlier on in the show, a lot of markets that are under 400,000 to 500,000 people aren't going to have a Trader Joe's in them, and that's something that the company is aiming to alleviate. For example, one of the openings is in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's the first Trader Joe's store in that particular market. They are also opening in Coralville, Iowa, as well as California, Jacksonville, Florida, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. So you see these store openings are spread out, and I think this is a reminder, this should serve as a reminder, that while Lidl is an up-and-coming threat, potentially long-term, to Trader Joe's, to Aldi, and a few other retailers on the East Coast, they still don't have the infrastructure available like what Trader Joe's has to expand in every area of the country. And we should still keep in mind that their prices on the whole beat Whole Foods. And even though not all of their products are necessarily akin to Whole Foods in terms of the organics, in terms of the all naturals, they're still able to speak to that market segment. They're still able to sell things like nice cheeses, for example, that are well lower than Whole Foods prices across the board. So unless there's more pricing pressure from Amazon here, you look at Trader Joe's, they're still very much a market leader in this category. And I'm looking ahead to what expansion plans they have for 2018, as they've already outlined a few store openings they've got their eyes on for the first quarter of 2018 and new store constructions that are going up for next year. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. So long until next week. Again, we'll be talking holograms with our interview guest next week and how they might be used in the retail space. We'll also be back with a fresh food focus 1 week from now.
Been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.